Hello and welcome to the Astor Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I am the Chief Investment Officer of Astor Investment Management. I'm joined by my friend and partner, Rob Stein, today. Rob, hello.
Hey, John. Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to all of our regular podcast listeners. Today, it is 10 o'clock, January 8th, Eastern Time. And so we got the payroll report about an hour ago, and we're going to try and slice that up as we do every payroll Friday. And after the payrolls, I think maybe we'll talk a little bit about the PMIs and maybe give a preview of where we see 2021 going, specifically the outlook for a boom in 2021 and what's that going to mean for prices. Okay, so we'll jump right in.
Right.
So let me just give the quick overview of the payroll numbers and then we can chat about them. Payroll numbers are negative today. Change in non-farm payrolls, minus 140,000. Change in private payrolls, minus 95,000. Unemployment rate actually ticked in the right direction, went from, actually stayed the same, I'm sorry, went to 6.7, stayed at 6.7.
Yeah, for the good reasons.
And so those are the basics. What do you see in the internals of the numbers that you wanted to dive into, Rob?
You know, as we were talking about previously in some of the other podcasts, the payroll report is becoming more difficult to forecast. The ranges have been pretty large, and you talk about 50,000 one way or the other, it's kind of tough. But, you know, Jen, average hourly earnings, you know, year over year, they've gone up pretty considerably. I know they're plateauing, but I find people would consider that an interesting phenomena. It could be connected, it obviously is, to the large savings rate that we have as well.
So the reason that the average hourly earnings is going up is a compositional effect. So basically, like, low wage people are losing jobs. You just can't look at this number for a while. If you look at the better surveys of wages that account for that, like the quarterly wages and salaries survey, that's down substantially on the year. So the hourly earnings is mainly a compositional effect.
Right. You're starting to get it with some of the other data as well. The denominator changes so much that, right, you get the skews in the data. But nevertheless, the headline number is what it is. And, you know, you have a high savings rate. Yeah, all part of it.
Yeah. So within the numbers, I would say that, you know, what you saw, what's interesting was that you see manufacturing jobs up in a month when payrolls are down overall, which is a little bit unusual. Talk about maybe some potential for a manufacturing-led recovery in a minute. You saw the biggest drop from leisure and hospitality employment. They were down about 500,000, most of which is from restaurants. So that's no surprise, right? Like, the virus is surging, people are staying home and shutting down restaurants. So not a super surprise, though. You know, I wonder if, you know, if the seasonals make this month look a little worse and it'll make next month look a little better, because usually what happens is November, December, retail stores hire people for the Christmas surge,
right,
and they fire them in January. And so if there's fewer hires, that might make this month look a little bit worse than it really was, kind of, and then next month could look a little bit better. So I would say one piece of modest good news is that the prime age employment population ratio has ticked up a little bit, and the long-term unemployment rate has ticked down a little bit. So it's not all bad news today. Before we leave the labor market, and we should point out, you know, our standard that, you know, we lost 22 million jobs, we've made 11 million back, and we're still sort of stuck below the worst part of the global financial crisis and heading in the wrong direction as of this month. So hopefully that corrects soon.
I think we should continue to point that out because, you know, highlighting a particular number, even a quarterly number now, without looking at its relevance is incredibly meaningful for where the economy really is. So I don't think you could beat that point too hard.
Yeah. Well, good, because we say it every week. Some of the small business indicators that we have, which are private companies, are ticking down a little bit, sort of consistent with other things we've seen. Jobless claims, not really showing a spike, but also not showing much recovery. You know, it's possible that some of those numbers were a little confused by the, I think there was like a 24-hour lapse in one of the programs. And so that might have messed up the pandemic unemployment insurance number a little bit. So we'll wait till next week to see if we can get a good reading on claims numbers. Was there more you want to talk about in labor market?
No, I think it is what it is. So no, we covered where it's coming from. So, John, while the unemployment rate remained the same, it's clear that we are starting to flatten on a lot of the data for the recovery. You pointed that out a month or two ago. I hadn't seen that the acceleration was fully stopping, but clearly, even if you look at a picture of this data, it does appear that employment trends are flattening from the bounce back.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I'd attribute that. Hopefully, that is just a function of the third wave that's going on right now, and that once as that dissipates, things will bounce back. But it is disturbing, right? So we went from adding 4 million jobs, adding 2 million jobs, adding 1 million jobs, adding 500,000 jobs, and now we're losing jobs again. And that's mm-hmm. not the way we want to be going.
No, right? I've seen that movie, but maybe this time it's a comedy, not a drama.
That's not the way we want to be going. And anyway, we'll talk about a little bit in our outlook. I mean, I do think that there's some reason to hope that 2021 is going to be substantially get us back on track. Before we jump into the preview, I want to talk quickly about the purchasing managers indices. So just remember that these are surveys of manufacturers or retail-oriented stores where they just ask people how their business is compared to last month. So they're good because they're super timely, but they're not sort of, you know, as accurate. They can be a little confusing sometimes. So the reason I bring that up, the big windup, is that the main manufacturing purchasing manager index came out at 60.7, so 60.7 of surveyed manufacturing establishments said they're doing things are better than last month, and that is a high for a long time.
At least 2 years, right, or a year and change.
Yeah, it's as high as so. That's as high. That's higher than it got. I mean, that's as high as it's been in this sort of V-shaped part of the recovery. It's higher than it ever got in the recovery from the Great Recession. It's high, high, high. There's kind of no two ways about it.
And the service sector?
The service sector is okay. It is in expansion mode. And, you know, there's alternate PMIs, and they're all selling sort of the same thing. Like, in general, manufacturers and service, most businesses are saying things are getting better at a pretty decent clip. One thing I wanted to highlight, though, is that, you know, industrial production is not going the same way as the manufacturing PMI. And you expect those, and then historically they've been quite closely related. And there's a big relative gap opening up where industrial production is still, you know, way down on the year, down 5% on the year, and got worse last month, got worse in November than it was in October. While the purchasing manager index is going up, 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 and the new orders index is going up, up, up. I guess I'm saying that one, this is a little bit of an oddball survey. You know, it can do strange things in periods where the economy is shut off, and maybe, you know, maybe it's just not a great survey for right now. But also, you know, I do think, and that's partially true, maybe, but I think
that was the point that I was going to echo too about, you know, the survey techniques. But
yeah, but I do think it is saying that there is room for substantial improvement, right? Like, these new orders being up so strong for so many months in a row. Like, eventually they have to start making stuff, right? Like, and selling it, and, you know, investing that money in, you know, boxes or new factories or whatever. So, like, that's one of the things I think is sort of that sort of gap in those softer numbers and the harder numbers, hopefully that means that the harder numbers are going to catch up, not that the softer numbers are going to reverse.
Yeah, and I think that looking at getting used to the way we consume, the way we produce, the way we move things around, transportation, logistics, it does make sense, right? We're finding new ways of not only producing and consuming, but basically contributing to the economy. So I would agree, the surveys are leading the hard numbers.
Yeah, so it's interesting also, you talk about change the way we consume, and even though, for example, so we've got the final numbers for car sales for 2020, and you know they were up sharply in the last few months, but you know, we do end up with fewer car sales by a lot, so the lowest car sales since 2011.
Right.
But your point about changing the sort of odd things about how we consume and make money and stuff like that, I think it brings us naturally into talking about 2021. And so I just want to just recap again where one place I see a big source of pent-up demand, right? And that's income and spending for 2020. So when you add up all the numbers for 2020 that we have so far, so wages were down in 2020, but not as much as you'd think, right? Wages were down about $40 billion. That's not that much. So now, and then we get all sorts of positives in there, right? We've got unemployment insurance benefits. We've got stimulus checks. We've got proprietors' income was even up that much. That's like sole proprietors, like little companies. And those would not have been up without the PPP.
Right. So I think that's an important point, John. I mean, you know, being highly incentivized to keep employees, and in some cases, it was more than dollar for dollar.
Yeah. And so, I mean, a lot of that money, I think, was misspent, probably. I probably would vote for it again. But like, you know, there's plenty of law firms that weren't going to lay anybody off. Everybody's working from home and they took the loans anyway and they get forgiven. And that like, and that just helps the partners. But anyway, so if we add up the numbers, you get about a $1 trillion increase in personal income. And then on the spending side, well, we spent a lot more on goods last year, $60 billion more in durable goods, $40 billion more in non-durable goods. In services, we spent $600 billion less than last year. And we also spent $60 billion less in interest payments. So you add all those up and you get back of the envelope, you know, a $1.5 trillion increase in savings, which is sort of just sitting around. And that is, you know, excess savings to what was desired. And when we look at the spending numbers, what it looks like is that all that money is really concentrated in high income places, in the highest quartile, right? So it's like the top 25% of the people by income are not making as many trips to Aspen, and they can only buy so many fancy TVs. So that's a huge potential. So on the one hand, it's a big chunk of money people can just spend. On the other hand, rich people have a lower propensity to spend than poor people, and the lowest quartiles spending rates are basically on average. So that's one of my big points for 2021.
Well, that's an important point, John. Supports a skew to these numbers. You know, clearly supports that it'll impact 2021. And by the way, that's not so inconsistent with the economy and things that people have been socially complaining about for you know, period of many, many years now.
What do you mean?
It's kind of reflective of income inequality and opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, money begets money.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, if you even look back at the great financial crisis, the way the banks and the loans for the top quartile, if not even a smaller part, were pretty substantial.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And you know, when you talk about the 2021 outlook, and I've got my 2021 outlook going through.
Oh yeah, definitely check the website AsterInvestmentManagement.com. Check out Rob 2021 outlook.
But so one of the things I think you can't ignore, and maybe we say this every year, but is the social implications of 2020. I often think that social, economic, and political issues, when they come together simultaneously, they make change. And boy, did we have a lot of that in 2020.
We did. We sure did. We sure did. You know, I think, so like one social thing is, can we ever have a recession again where people don't get big checks from the government? That happened. It happened a little bit in the last recession. It happened big this time. And so like, that's going to be the first thing people reach for, right? That's like, you're not going to have any excuses.
John, you make a great point. And, you know, going back decades when I spent a little bit of time at the Fed, it was very different. And it does seem like whenever they unlock a new policy, you know, you rarely, if ever, heard the term quantitative easing. And they often talk about, you know, one time or a tool that is there for emergencies. They become commonplace policies. and even making their way into the, you know, the communication after rate announcements. So I think that's a great point. Our recession is going to be different, and is Fed policy now for forever changed how we deal with it, and how do we look at that?
Yeah, I think that's true. Do you have any thoughts on like what you think? So the Democrats won the Senate, assuming nobody switches sides, which is not impossible. That guy from West Virginia is basically a Republican, and you know, if he's promised enough money, like he could definitely go over. But let's say the Democrats do have the Senate. Do you have any views on another stimulus check or anything like coming down the pike?
Yeah, so I think you make a good point that party line voting might be less substantial as it's been in the past. I'm not as, you know, if it went the other way, I would say, you know, for sure we would have policy that went right down the middle of policy lines. But you could see the minute that it was clear that the Democrats were taking control, bond yields went up. If you think the markets are able to forecast things, there's clearly expectation of more stimulus policies that are much more accommodative and putting more resources behind getting this economy accelerating again. So
I mean, bond yields went up. They went up 10 basis points. Let's not exaggerate the.
Yeah, I get that, right? But it is the, you know,
it's
the direction
of the curve. And the stock market's up, and most people are interpreting that as being there's going to be additional fiscal stimulus. And yeah, I mean, I do see more stimulus coming. Exactly what's going to happen, I don't know. People are talking about a $2,000 check. Ultimately, so this circling back to the inequality issue, like ultimately if we're, you know, we send out checks to people lower income and eventually tax people with higher incomes, that's going to be some redistribution and might get at the some of those other issues. I know that you
and John, I think that expectations and the things that both parties say they want to accomplish, and I, you know, I get that they have both the House and the Senate, they usually get wheeled in a little bit. And so it'll be interesting, you know, certainly what do they look at the first 100 days? It'll be interesting to see how aggressive some of these policies ultimately end up being.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way the politics sort of shakes out is that, you know, there's the sort of the 50th senator. So with a spending only bill, you can pass it by reconciliation. So you don't necessarily, even if they don't get rid of the filibuster, that's still relevant. The 50th senator is actually quite conservative, but presumably he can be bought off by enough military bases in Virginia. I do think that there is a decent chance for a large stimulus, but we will see. There's a lot to do in the first 100 days, right? Like they want to do, they've got HR1, which is about voting reform. Everybody should just be focused primarily on getting the vaccines out, and then and whatever fallout from the last week's excitement happens also. So we will see.
You know, I want to touch on the vaccine rollout. You know, logistically speaking, you know, it seems like, okay, we have it, let's go. But hundreds of millions of vaccines and people getting in line for them. And then, you know, how do you store them? Is there problems? I don't think that, I think you're going to see some hiccups.
I think it's been a disaster. I think we've had 9 months to think about this. The federal government said, you know, states can do it. The states are saying the counties can do it. The counties are saying, oh, maybe I can set up a GoFundMe so I can get so we can order, you know, a booth at the shopping center. You know, New York City has only distributed a third of its vaccines that it's in the last three or four weeks. Mm-hmm. The ones that it's gotten, right? So they're just sitting there in freezers somewhere. And it's not like, you know, that's New York City. Like, your cab ride away, your subway ride away. Right. Here it is, and it's.
Meanwhile, a small island off the coast is vaccinated every single person and has 10,000 excess vials of vaccines.
Exactly. Well, Israel's the only one who's doing it right. Israel's gotten my mom's gotten vaccinated though. She's in a assisted living home, so so they are prioritizing those people. I know.
And I'll tell you, I was on a client call. Somebody in Georgia, and he basically said his mother got the vaccine in less than 10 minutes. A friend of my mother's was in a car in Florida for over 3 hours. So clearly, state by state, plan.
Anyway, I think that's going poorly as far as I can see. Hopefully, it turns around. I know before we wrap up, you have been beating the inflation 2021 drum. I'm a little more skeptical of that. Do you want to make your case?
Several months ago, as we were coming from some of the policies, you didn't have it as divided as much. It was, you know, very, very small universe of people that thought there'd be inflation. And it's data driven. The data isn't quite supporting it as much as I'll call it my gut. But you are starting to see appreciation in assets, I think, driven by the reasons that I feel we're going to have inflation. Some of the non-traditional assets have gone through the roof, copper, lumber, things like that. I'm starting to really see levels that I think support inflation. We talked about wages. I think that I know that it's a misleading number, but when you look back at some of the causes of inflation, that'll definitely be in your data series. So I'm finally starting to see some reasons that I can have a meaningful argument or conversation. But, if you look purely at, CPI data and the PCE data, it's clearly not even near Fed target yet. But I'm starting to see the signs that I could point to other than just lots of money and fewer goods and that causes inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's going to be a surge in inflation in 2021. I do think it's going to be transitory, though. And I also think, more to the point, the Fed thinks it's transitory. I mean, there's a lot of, so the dollar's down, exports are down, but imports are up. There is all this money sloshing around.
But it's more than sloshing around. I mean, I get that, I think there's so much money sloshing around that it's actually becoming a bit of a dam burst. And so while I can't connect the full dots yet, and I'm obviously pounding the money supply growth as the driver of it and some of the production contraction as the secondary reason, it just seems to me, John, that we've had a very long period of time of declining rates, inflation below targets. And if you're going to look for a catalyst of that oscillating data point, you might be pointing to 2020 and the pandemic as the beginning of things that have changed this long-term declining inflation trend we've had for many decades.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That's true. So the other thing is like, oh gosh, maybe a lot of the secular inflation decline from 2000 to today was globalization, right? So the supply chains and, offshoring, and to some extent that might be reversed, which is...
You can only get so much from that, right? And decades of it might be enough. And by the way, John, not to interrupt, I don't think the Fed would be so disappointed.
No, the Fed is going to tolerate inflation if it sees it transitory, right? The Fed is going to tolerate, and they've said that exactly. What's their line? We don't know what their line is, but they want inflation to be closer to average, closer to 2, not print 2 once in a while. But the other thing I was going to say, and this is a point, the anti-inflation point, and one that you've made before, is that this Zoom revolution, could that be the beginning of a secular inflation decline in services, right? Where if we all can work from home, does that make wages go down a little bit over the next 20 years as that gets more sort of baked into the regular way the economy works, not just once in a while?
No, I think that's a good point. Wages are relatively inelastic on the downside. Purchasing power will probably decline and maybe you see it that way. But I think it's people are getting tired of Zoom and looking at a computer. I think it is the beginning of a revolution. And I don't know what the next iteration of communicating, we joked about a hologram in front of you. But I think, again, you make a great point. Efficiencies will help put a lid on inflation. And clearly this work from home, the way we communicate, the way we deliver goods is clearly going to make my inflation expectation a little more muted. That's what's happened in the past.
But that could be a secular effect. You're still going to see a short-term bump. I still expect to see a short-term inflation bump in 2021. But like I said, I think that's going to be transitory. And I don't think the Fed will react to it. Okay, you want to wrap it up, Rob?
Yes, I think we've covered it for earlier in the year. We'll have a lot more to talk about, certainly as the data unfolds.
We will. Next week, market calendars, we're going to have a special guest, Elizabeth Panicotti, a labor market expert. We're going to go deep dive into some of the details of the jobless claims and also hopefully into the JOLTS numbers, as well as our regular report. And in the meantime, you can find a ton of additional information on our website, asterim.com. or the Aster app, which you can find on your favorite app store.
Great, John. It was terrific doing the first podcast of the year. You know, it'll be fun. 1 year from now, we come back and we take a look at this particular podcast.
We should have that an annual feature where we're like held up to our predictions and stuff.
Sure. Anyway, have a great weekend. See you in the IC meeting.
See you in the IC.
And enjoy.
Cheers. All right. Bye.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.